This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
the first wave of attackers were carrying knives and machetes, and they proceeded to kill people, stabbing them and hacking them to death.
That's Louis Mudge of Human Rights Watch describing a rebel attack on a displacement camp in Central African Republic. HRW says UN peacekeepers failed to prevent the attack. Details coming up.
Also, the Nigerian government has opened peace talks with militants in the Niger Delta region, and the illicit global trade in wildlife could contribute to the spread of disease.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, once again, UN peacekeepers are facing allegations that they failed to protect civilians from armed attackers. Human Rights Watch says peacekeepers deployed outside a camp for the displaced in Central African Republic did not halt an attack by Seleka rebels. The group says 37 civilians were killed and nearly 60 wounded. Human Rights Watch says it happened north of the capital Bangui in the town of Kagabandoro. For the past 3 years, mostly Christian and animist militias known as anti-Balaka have been battling mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. Louis Mudge is Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the attack, which occurred October 12th.
In revenge for the killing of a Seleka fighter, Seleka groups based in Kagabandoro laid an attack out on a displacement camp. The first wave of attackers were carrying knives and machetes, and they proceeded to kill people, stabbing them and hacking them to death. And then very, very shortly after, Seleka fighters on motorcycles and armed with Kalashnikovs crossed over from the Muslim side of the town, because the town is divided, and attacked the camp and the neighborhoods around the camp, burning hundreds of huts, burning people alive in the camp, including the elderly and people with disabilities, killing women and children. These are people living in this zone between anti-Balaka militia and Seleka fighters. This camp was protected by MINUSCA, the United Nations peacekeeping mission. And while eventually the MINUSCA Blue Helmets did engage with the Seleka and did try to protect civilians, frankly, what we've ascertained is that it was just too late. When the Seleka started to kill civilians, the UN mission did not at that point take appropriate action, and that basically enabled and allowed the situation to just spiral completely out of control.
Give me an idea where this town is located in relation to the capital.
Kagabandoro is the capital of Nanagrabezi province. It is approximately 250, if I'm not mistaken, kilometers north of Bangui. It's a town that really is at the front of Seleka-held territory. There are two main Seleka groups that operate in this town. Insecurity since September has escalated to such a point where now it's very, very difficult to access this town by road, and so life-saving humanitarian assistance for the moment is having to be flown in by the UN and by aid agencies.
Now, to remind our listeners, the Seleka rebels are mostly Muslim, so I'm assuming that most of those in the camp were Christian and animist?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The majority of victims, we could say, are non-Muslim. The majority of the attackers were Muslim Seleka rebels.
Now, I understand that Seleka leaders told Human Rights Watch that they did not take part in this attack.
Look, we've been following this crisis for over 3 years now, and we're sort of used to this old song and dance. They continue to deny that their fighters took part, even in the face of overwhelming evidence that we had, that they did take part. This is a protracted conflict in Kagabandoro. These displaced people, in many instances, knew by name, by first name, their attackers, because it's been 3 years now where they've been sort of living in fear of these individuals. So we had many instances in which we knew the actual attackers. We had instances in which Seleka commanders, such as Saleh Zabadi, an individual well known to Human Rights Watch, was there when the attack was sort of unfolding. He was seen in the area when the attackers were gathering and organizing. And so for the Seleka simply to deny it, I think really reflects the fact that they feel that they can get away with murder in territory that they hold.
Now, let me ask you more about the UN aspect of this story. The allegations that Human Rights Watch is making sound similar to those being made against UN peacekeepers in South Sudan when they were accused of not protecting civilians during fighting around Juba last July.
As you know, I focus on Central African Republic, so I certainly can attest to South Sudan and what peacekeepers may or may not have done. What I can tell you in Kagabandoro is this. There's a fixed point between these two neighborhoods, and it's a bridge. And on that bridge, there was a fixed post of UN peacekeepers. Now, these peacekeepers are operating under a Chapter 7 mandate of the United Nations, which means that they are allowed to take force in the protection of civilians. The attackers came over in waves. The first wave was armed with basically machetes and knives. And they started killing people very, very quickly. Once that started to unfold, the UN would have been authorized to have used force to prevent further attackers from crossing this bridge, and they simply didn't. And I think that's a question that the UN needs to ask itself and to do some investigations on as to why that action wasn't taken. It is worth pointing out that when the attackers finally made it to this large displacement camp with thousands of people, the Blue Helmets, the UN force, did engage, and they did kill roughly a dozen Seleka fighters. But by that point, it was too late. Well over 60 Seleka fighters had already crossed over into this territory. They were able to easily outflank the UN positions and get into the camp and kill women and children.
So what is Human Rights Watch calling on the United Nations to do at this point?
We think the UN needs to double its efforts and really recognize that according to its mandate, it has to protect civilians. That's the first thing. The second thing is the UN, alongside national authorities and international donors, they need to recognize that the Seleka are going to continue doing this as long as they feel they can get away with it. What they also need to focus on is accountability, and there's a special criminal court, which will be made up of national and international prosecutors and magistrates, which is on the books in Car. It's slowly getting started, but it needs international support to get going, because that really is the only institution that's capable of holding some of these warlords to account.
Louis Mudge is Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. From Nairobi, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. In related news, the UN says the MINUSCA force in CAR has reinforced its presence while maintaining a robust posture in Kagabandora, including by conducting air patrols. No word yet on a UN response to the Human Rights Watch allegations against peacekeepers.
An independent investigation into the July clashes in South Sudan's capital has concluded that UN military and mission personnel failed to protect civilians and aid workers. VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir has details.
The investigation, headed by retired Dutch General Patrick Kamert, found that a lack of leadership on the part of key senior mission personnel culminated in a chaotic and ineffective response to the violence. The fighting between government soldiers supporting President Salva Kiir and troops loyal to opposition leader Riek Machar erupted July 8th near the presidential palace. More than 300 people were killed, and the fighting led to attacks, killings, rapes, looting, and other atrocities on the local population and foreign aid workers. Peacekeepers from China and Nepal were singled out for their poor performance during the episode. UN peacekeepers were also generally criticized for having a risk-averse posture not suited to protecting civilians from sexual violence and other attacks, and for not regularly patrolling outside their perimeter at night. UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric told reporters Tuesday that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has asked for the force commander to be immediately replaced. He added that the UN chief is deeply distressed by these findings and will implement the investigators' recommendations. Those include that the UN further investigate peacekeeper shortcomings and hold the relevant actors accountable for their failures to protect. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Thank you, Margaret. Well, many of the refugees fleeing from South Sudan into Uganda are children who are traveling alone. For example, Lutheran World Federation aid workers say there are at least 1,500 unaccompanied minors in the Numazi refugee camp in northern Uganda. Magumbi Davis Rakawenge has more on the story.
Lutheran World Federation officials say the miners live in fear and suffer from trauma due to some of the violence they witnessed.
Life is very hard when you live without your parents. Sometimes we don't attend school because we do not have exercise book or evening school fees, no food.
10-year-old Manyang Deng breaks down as explains in Dinka the troubles he has to endure every day as a refugee child without parents. Deng's father died last year, and Deng has taken up the responsibility of looking after his two young brothers, aged 6 and 4. A 24-year-old neighbor, Adao Deng, was concerned about the welfare of Deng and his two brothers and decided to take care of the three minors, even though she's not related to them. Speaking in Dinka, the single mother of four says taking care of unaccompanied minors can be a daunting task.
Whenever I tell them to go and fetch water for bathing, they refuse. I usually have to go and fetch myself. When I try to correct these young children, for example, after a simple fight, they get annoyed and refuse to eat food. Maybe if they had their parents, they could easily understand. And this is giving me a lot of stress.
Abraham Bior, who also takes care of an accompanied minor, agrees. Bior lives with a 15-year-old girl who does not know the whereabouts of her parents. Bior says providing for his adopted daughter is challenging.
If you want to advise them, you thought that you are busy. They are just, maybe they refuse to eat again, totally. Like for me now, we have the other lady there in our home there. He's staying with us. But some days, we want to talk to her because he went away from the school and he come to the community. Now this report came from the school. This lady is always going home. When we come and advise her, he refused for 3 days without eat. Now the sickness entered to the body. Now it's very serious thing now, even it's here now in the hospital.
16-year-old Adith Dao is one of the minors staying in this camp. She says she ran with her now 8-year-old brother to the bush in Jonglei State's Duke County when fighting broke out in her area in early 2014. After walking for days, they reached Bor County, where uncle managed to give them money for transport to Juba and eventually to a refugee camp in Uganda. Speaking in Dinka, Adith says she still doesn't know the whereabouts of her parents.
It is difficult taking care of my brother. When we return from school, we normally find nothing to eat at home. And my young brother usually starts crying. And we do not have other necessities like exercise books. It's a real challenge.
Alice Irene Badaru is the Field Extensive Officer for the World Federation, one of the NGOs providing humanitarian aid to refugees here. Badaru confirms there are more than 1,500 unaccompanied minors and children living in this camp. She says, besides children who live alone, the other children living with adult relatives, including grandmothers, were unable to provide for the minors. Badaru says her organization is providing psychosocial counseling to both foster parents and minors.
We gave in some houses for a few of them to at least make them feel comfortable, house and latrine, to make a standard home. Then to some of them, we've given these mattresses, these NFIs, let's say, what can keep a home at least comfortable. So this is just to make them, the people who are keeping them, to also feel at comfort. This is to also so that when you keep someone, you equally can benefit.
According to statistics published by the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, in early October, more than 190,000 South Sudanese refugees reside in Uganda's Adjumani district. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Adjumani district, northern Uganda.
At their height earlier this year, attacks by militants in Nigeria's Niger Delta cut the country's oil production nearly in half. Now, the Nigerian government has opened talks aimed at restoring peace in the oil-producing region. Chika Oduwa reports from Abuja.
Community leaders from the Niger Delta took part in a closed-door meeting with President Muhammadu Buhari at the State House in Abuja Tuesday. The government hopes the talks will help pave the way to peace in the Niger Delta and allow full oil production to resume, a development that would give a big boost to Nigeria's ailing economy. For decades, youth in the Delta have protested against the government, prompted mainly by widespread poverty and accusations that oil companies have polluted the land. A new group called the Niger Delta Avengers has claimed responsibility for dozens of attacks on oil pipelines and other infrastructure in the region in the past year. But the Niger Delta Avengers did not send its spokesperson to today's meeting. The group remains anonymous.
You can see there are issues from the representation. There have been complaints here and there. But today is about an inaugural meeting. We have informed everybody that, look, let us allow for this process to begin.
Udeng's Iradiri spoke to VOA before attending the meeting. He's the president of the Ijaw Youth Council, a highly influential community group formed nearly two decades ago to voice the concerns of the Niger Delta people. The Ijaw Youth Council played a huge role in helping to broker the 2009 deal between the government and militants that ended a previous wave of attacks on oil facilities. But Iradiri had reservations about what could be achieved Tuesday.
We're not expecting much out of this meeting. And so whatever we'll be doing today will just be window dressing. We believe that Nigeria's problems need to be solved once and for all. And in order to do that, we must revisit our constitution.
Groups like the Ijaw Youth Council and the Niger Delta Avengers have been demanding more localized control of the wealth generated from the oil pumped out of their communities. That would mean changing the structure of Nigeria's federalism to give more power to the states. The Nigerian government is hoping to satisfy the demands by bringing much-needed development to the Niger Delta. Last week, President Buhari announced a plan to launch a $10 billion infrastructure investment program in the region.
Everybody is aware of the importance of oil to Nigeria. And the government is very sincere in bringing peace. And the meeting is very, very representative of all the stakeholders in the Niger Delta.
Idang Alibi, the media advisor to the state oil minister, told VOA he was very optimistic that Tuesday's meeting in Abuja would be successful. He also said that negotiating peace does not happen in a day. Chika Odua for VOA News, Abuja.
22 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. While revenue from the illicit global trade in wildlife amounts to tens of billions of dollars annually, it ranks fourth after the illegal trade of drugs, human trafficking, and weapons. However, a lesser-known facet of the illegal trade of wildlife is the wide variety of infectious diseases that are inadvertently spread around the world. They are called zoonotic infection diseases because they spread from animals to humans or humans to animals. Dr. Bill Miller is a physician, independent researcher, and infectious disease expert who says zoonotic diseases include SARS, Ebola, HIV, and MERS. Miller warns the illegal wildlife trade has opened the door for other such diseases to emerge unless action is taken to stop it.
Many people are upset about the possibilities of climate change, and that gets an awful lot of press. But we are changing climate in a way that we haven't thought before. We're taking exotic animals, exotic primates, reptiles, even insects, all sorts of animals, many of which occupy their own unique niche in an ecology, from one part of the planet, and we're transplanting them sometimes halfway around the world and putting them into new environments. This is precisely the breeding ground for novel infectious diseases. And what we have learned about infectious disease is that the most important scourges, the diseases that we care about the most, about 60% or more of them are what are termed zoonotic diseases, Kim. That means that they skip from one animal host to another, so they can go from a primate to a human, like Ebola, or they can go from actually humans over to other sorts of animals. So this transmission crosses across species. Furthermore, in this process of transporting, they're kept in cages. Of course, they're being tortured. We all know the moral reasons not to do this. But the way they're housed is completely unlike the way that they are naturally in their wild habitat. Species are being put next to species that are not normally in contact, which is the perfect breeding ground for infectious disease. Let's take the SARS epidemic, which is a good example. That's the severe acute respiratory syndrome. That originated in bats, and then it spread to civets. These are little nocturnal mammals that are native to Asia and Africa, they're very coveted in the illegal wildlife trade. And from that, it jumped to humans. And in 2003, there was an epidemic in China and Hong Kong in which there were 8,000 people infected at the minimum and at least 700 deaths. So we're talking about infections that can have enormous consequences.
Looking at what's happening today in the illegal wildlife trade, we have seen how some diseases are transmitted. So what is the health impact on societies?
My point is that there is a highly consequential risk that is being ignored. Something like SARS, or there's a thing called MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, another devastating disease that had its consequences in the Middle East. These are all zoonotic infections. HIV was a zoonotic infection. Look at those consequences. The next terrible plague is always around the corner. And although we may think that we are now smarter with antibiotics and vaccinations, and we don't know what the next plague will be like and how tough it will be to deal with. My point is, let's start to recognize that this illegal trade has this potential consequence, and let's start to enact measures that will attempt to mitigate that risk by diminishing the amount of that trade, by increasing the surveillance and the kinds of controls to fight corruption that underlies this. We need objective agencies to look at these animals. And by the way, Kim, this really affects our domesticated animal trade. We trade living animals across borders, ship them transnationally for many purposes as legal pets, as legal farm animals. Many of these receive very little attention. And someday we'll look back and we'll say, boy, I wish we had thought about it. I'm saying, let's do that. Let's think about it now, because of the history is filled with the consequences of just this kind of activity. And then out of nowhere, sometimes separated by 80 years, sometimes 12 years, sometimes a century and a half, something really terrible happens, and it would be a shame for us not to be prepared.
If something else will come up, another disease, maybe something even worse than Ebola.
You know, I'm talking about what are the consequences, and I don't want people to think I'm just a pure and simple alarmist without a factual background. There are examples of these kinds of zoonotic infections that have either been linked to extinctions directly or came very close. I'll give you a number of examples, because we're talking about humans, too, when we're talking about illegal trafficking and bad conditions and crowding and all sorts. When the conquistadors came to the New World from Spain and Portugal, they came with a hidden weapon, typhus, measles, and smallpox. And the conquering of the New World by the Old World was almost entirely due to infectious disease. 90% of the Native American, the indigenous population, it is estimated, was wiped out by the combination of those three diseases, zoonotic infections. Those consequences are real. There could be extinctions. They could be across species. It could be near extinctions. We are finding out, as we learn more and more, that there's a very delicate balance between us as animals and plants, too, with the microbial sphere. This is really the area of where there's going to be intense research and understanding.
Dr. Bill Miller is a physician, independent researcher, infectious disease expert, and author. He spoke with me from Phoenix, Arizona.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports, coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Political conventions are a critical part of the American electoral process. Our job is to put the conventions, the candidates, and the issues into context for our listeners. Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic Party's conventions starting July 18th. on VOA.